assessment. Move to the fourth case this morning, Gowdy versus Finnan.
May it please the Court. It is undisputed that, on the one hand, the prosecution in this case suppressed evidence favorable to my client, and on the other hand, that my client's trial counsel was deficient, resulting in further exculpatory evidence that never reached the jury. The only question before the Indiana Court of Appeals, and correspondingly the question before this Court, is whether all that favorable evidence would have made a difference at Walter's trial. Now, given that two and only two gunmen shot Marvin McLeod and Damon Nunn, and given that the exculpatory evidence clearly points to two other men, Katie Harvell and Ellis Thomas Jr., as those two gunmen, there simply is no question that it would have made a difference at Walter's trial to have this evidence. And the state court's holding to the contrary is simply unreasonable. Now, the facts of this case are highly unusual. In fact, it appears that Walter was only convicted because of a problem of bad timing. At Thomas's trial, the state freely admits that it fully intended to convict Harvell next as the second gunman, and it only wanted to use him for the time being as a useful witness at Walter's trial. Then, during Walter's trial, it learned of Thomas's taped confession. At this point, Walter was almost convicted, and Thomas had become low-lying fruit for the prosecution. And the prosecution simply gave up on Harvell, which is strange given that Harvell was identified by four eyewitnesses as the gunman on the driver's side of the vehicle, that Harvell actually failed the lie detector test based on the exact same testimony he gave at Walter's trial, and finally that Harvell actually admits he was present at the scene of the crime at the time of the shooting. He has no alibi defense or any other way to explain away his presence. Now, the missing evidence cumulatively certainly points to Walter's innocence in this case, but Walter does not actually seek to rely on actual innocence before this court, nor did he in the Indiana Court of Appeals. Instead, he complains of two grievous constitutional errors at his trial. He must show only that there is reason to think that a jury that had heard all of this evidence would have come out differently, that it would not still have found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And on the one hand, the Brady error in this case results in numerous pieces of exculpatory evidence that were concealed from the jury. Most important among these, though certainly not the only one, are the fact that four eyewitnesses identified Harvell as the gunman on the driver's side. On the other hand, thanks to ineffective trial counsel, the jury never heard Thomas's taped confession, in which he explains that he and Harvell were the two that committed this crime, and that Walter actually had nothing to do with it. Now, this cumulative error in this case, and the evidence that was omitted because of it, is just staggering. And the state utterly fails to even address that staggering effect that cumulative error had on the fairness of Walter's trial. But even setting to the side cumulative error, Your Honors, each one of Walter's two claims for habeas relief would suffice. Turning first to the Brady error, again, everyone agrees that favorable evidence was in fact suppressed by the prosecution. But the state court's finding that that favorable evidence would have been immaterial simply cannot stand in light of Kyles v. Whitley. First, that decision is unreasonable in light of Kyles, because the state court failed to conduct the searching, cumulative inquiry that Kyles requires. The Supreme Court has time and time again explained that the touchstone of Kyles is that cumulative analysis of all the excluded evidence. Instead of doing that, what the Indiana Court of Appeals did in its opinion was take each individual piece of Brady evidence, weigh that single piece against all of the inculpatory evidence introduced at trial, and conclude that that single piece didn't matter. This is patently unreasonable in light of Kyle's, and it's something that the Supreme Court has actually censured state and federal courts for doing in the Brady analysis, most recently in Cohn v. Bell just this year. But secondly, the decision of the state's court here is contrary to Kyle's, because the facts of Walter's case are simply indistinguishable from the facts of Kyle's. You have the same sort of errors. They match almost one-to-one, as our reply brief demonstrates. And almost most surprisingly is the fact that you have just the overwhelming facts of the case are so similar. In both cases, you have the police sort of blindly relying on a really hard-to-believe, really incredible third party, in this case Harvell, and blindly accepting his version of events and using that version of events to prosecute, in this case, Walter, and convict him. In the Kyle's case, the Supreme Court talked about how if all the Brady evidence had come in, the jury would really have been entitled to doubt the good faith of the police investigation and the good faith of the prosecution in putting this third party on the stand and allowing them to testify to what seemed to be a fabricated story. Just like in Kyle's, in Walter's case, the jury never had the chance to make that finding, because all of this evidence that pointed to Harvell, that threw significant doubt on the state's case, was never presented to the jury. In fact, was never given to Walter's counsel. Therefore, both because it's unreasonable and because it's contrary to Kyle's, the state court's analysis of the Brady issue cannot stand. Moving to ineffective assistance, Your Honors, again, the courts below found that Walter's trial counsel was deficient for failing to introduce the Thomas tape statement. They both held that he should have entered the tape into evidence. However, again, the state court was unreasonable, this time in its application of Strickland, in coming to the conclusion that Walter was not prejudiced by this deficient counsel. It held so because it held that the confession was unreliable. But that runs counter both to the weight of federal precedent, which has in numerous cases has held that third-party confessions are inherently credible, even if they happen to be given by a close relative of the defendant, because the person giving the confession is not merely trying to supply an alibi, but actually putting their own head on the chopping block. But more so, the state court's finding is unreasonable because in the very facts of this case and of the greater crime, you have Ellis Thomas Jr. convicted of murder and attempted murder almost exclusively based on his taped confession. So clearly you have a jury willing to find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt based on this taped confession and little else, and yet the state would like you to believe that a jury would not have found reasonable doubt as to Walter's guilt based on that same taped confession. Now, this credible confession established first that Thomas and Harvell were the two gunmen and that Walter was not even present at the scene of the crime, and secondly, and possibly even more importantly, explained away the state's most important evidence, which were those four eyewitness testimonies, because Thomas explains how similar he and Walter look, and that actually, as a matter of fact, on that night at the Oasis Bar, several patrons thought that it was Walter, and he had to correct them and explain that he was actually Walter's younger half-brother. Now, given what this evidence adds to the case, again, it is simply unreasonable to conclude, as the state court did, that it was not material, that the failure to have this evidence before the jury did not prejudice Walter's trial. Now, ultimately, as I said, the only question before this court is whether all this evidence was material to Walter's trial. And based on either error in this case, this court can find huge amounts of exculpatory evidence that had to be before the jury and was not. As a result, this court cannot allow the Indiana State Court of Appeals opinion to stand, and it must reverse the district court's decision and grant Walter his writ. Thank you. I would like to remove, I guess, take the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. This court should affirm the district court in finding that the Indiana Court of Appeals reasonably applied clearly established federal law to these claims and correctly concluded that there was no Brady violation and that trial counsel did not render ineffective assistance. I think initially it's important to point out that Gowdy's positions here assume that he walks into this proceeding and this investigation as a person who was in the wrong place at the wrong time or that had a believable alibi. To be clear, this record establishes that Mr. Gowdy's alibi was utterly destroyed at trial. And walking in to this investigation, Mr. Gowdy, who, by the way, it should be mentioned also, the leads had gone dead in the investigation of this case. It wasn't until Gowdy re-entered the Oasis Bar, which was in proximity to the place where the murders occurred, that totally disinterested witnesses recognized him and alerted police to his presence there. He was then arrested. Then Mr. Gowdy tells the police that he is a James Benneman and allows police to labor under that misconception during their initial investigation of him. He assures police when he's released that he will return for a lineup, and the police told him when that lineup was scheduled, and he did not return. He had to be arrested on a limited warrant to be brought back for that purpose. Again, there are a number of disinterested witnesses that place Gowdy in Anderson at the Oasis proximate to these murder and these shootings. For Ellis Thomas's taped confession to be believed, one would have to believe that alibi coming from his brother in an effort to exculpate his brother when Romeo Lee, the brother, was incarcerated in Arizona and I think by all accounts thought that he wasn't going to have to come back and support and stand behind this decision, which subsequent history in the case shows is exactly how it played out. So if I could just address the ineffective assistance claim initially. If that issue had been pushed, trial counsel knew what he was going to get, and he wisely stayed away from it. The state, in fact, affirmatively tried to use this taped confession to impeach the testimony that was elicited from Romeo Lee to support Gowdy's alibi. Going back to the claims that evidence was suppressed, my opponent wrongly states that everyone agrees that favorable evidence was suppressed here. What happened was these police reports, Gowdy's trial counsel tried to have these police reports made part of the record during the trial proceedings, but what he did was ask for a blanket provision of police reports, and Indiana law prohibited that. And in regard to his request for an in-camera review of the police reports, it similarly was a blanket request, and that's why it was denied. After the fact, they became aware of these police reports and tried to supplement the appellate record with them. The Indiana Supreme Court said that that was improper, A, because these were not before the trial court, and that's the judgment that they are appealing from, and that post-conviction was available for that purpose. So they were admitted in post-conviction. There is not a showing of diligence here. However, the Indiana Court of Appeals, in addressing the merits of this claim on remand, went ahead and went to the materiality of the claim. But I think it's interesting to note, and I think that the most instructive source of information on this is the post-conviction court's findings of fact and conclusions of law, is the trial counsel had every reason to know that Kadai Harvell had been identified by witnesses. The state's Exhibit 2 in the post-conviction proceedings was the charging information against Kadai Harvell, and it was accompanied by the probable cause affidavit, which clearly states that he had been picked out of a lineup by witnesses. Moreover, one of the witnesses at Gowdy's trial, and I'm pretty sure that this was Jill Barclay, was asked expressly by Gowdy's trial counsel about the identification that she'd given police, and she expressly said that she had identified another suspect. Trial counsel didn't even follow up on this. This wasn't an accident that he didn't do this. It's because identification, placing Kadai Harvell as one of the shooters in this case, does nothing to support Gowdy's defense, which was alibi and mistaken identity. The fact that Gowdy now alludes to identifications of Harvell as the second gunman would only have showed that the state's witnesses that identified Gowdy as a gunman also had correctly observed who the second gunman was. Rather than doing that, trial counsel presented this by way of accusation of Kadai Harvell while he was on the stand, and basically said it was you and Romeo Lee that were the shooters, was it not? But he didn't go so far as to get these witnesses to say that they also had identified Harvell, because that would have undermined his general tactic, which was to make it look like there could be some doubt about the identification of Gowdy. However, we have two witnesses here, again, who have no incentive to inculpate Gowdy unless they believe that he was actually the person responsible for the shootings, that were inside the car that survived this attack and identified him as the passenger side gunman. Jackie Barclay, the sister of one of the survivors that was inside the car, also identified Gowdy as one of the gunmen. These police reports that suggest that these people identified Kadai Harvell as the driver's side gunman would not have impeached that testimony, and the Court of Appeals correctly recognized that. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. There was no benefit to be had in Gowdy's defense by placing Harvell at the crime scene as a shooter. Trial counsel didn't attempt to do it. Trial counsel had the opportunity and the knowledge and the means to do it. The information and the probable cause affidavit filed against Kadai Harvell were public information. And as Mr. Gowdy admits in these proceedings in his brief, the defense was well aware of these witnesses on the state's witness list, and he could have just checked that. You would assume that if he was interested in doing that in order to present a defense, that he would have investigated these easily ascertainable sources of information. The Indiana Court of Appeals was quite reasonable in concluding that there was no Brady violation shown here, and also that there was no failure on the part of trial counsel in failing to present this inherently incredible confession that was offered by Gowdy's brother. If this court doesn't have further questions, I would just rely on the argument in my brief and what the record establishes in this case as supportive of the state court judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Curtis? You have 5 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, I'm a little perplexed because apparently I'm not here arguing what I thought I was. I thought the only issues left in this case were the materiality, both on the Brady prong and on the Strickland prong. In both cases, the courts below agreed that the other parts of those two constitutional errors had been made out. In the case of the Brady error, there is no question that there was prosecutorial suppression in this instance. Nowhere in any of the opinions below is there any indication that this information was independently available. In fact, quite the opposite. The Indiana Supreme Court on direct appeal, when it first learned of this information through a supplemental brief, said that counsel had been diligent, but that this information had been suppressed and therefore had to be brought up on post-conviction. Now, all of the discussion that the state brought up about Indiana case law regarding whether or not police reports have to be handed over is completely inapposite in the Brady context. First of all, it does not matter whether there was a request for exculpatory evidence and whether that request was or was not adequate. Under Brady, the state has an automatic duty to hand over any exculpatory evidence in its possession. Even if there's no request, even if there's a bad request, or if there's a specific request that asks for exactly what's at issue. Therefore, whether or not counsel was diligent in asking the right questions is not the issue.
Maybe we ought to get, though, to the crux of this matter.
Yes, Your Honor.
The state says, look, if you guys had known about this, it wouldn't have made any difference. It would have just shown that this character was one of the other shooters. It doesn't mean that your guy wasn't there, too. That's basically their case, as I understand it.
Yeah.
What's wrong with it?
Yes, Your Honor. What's wrong with it is that it's simply inconceivable that when it was consistently my client's story throughout trial, throughout every stage of the appellate and post-conviction process, that he was not there and that it was Katie Harvell and Ellis Thomas who were the two gunmen. That was always the theory. It's inconceivable that if they had all of this evidence that points to Katie Harvell as being one of the two gunmen, indeed that points out that he was always identified as the gunman on the driver's side of the vehicle, which, conveniently enough, is exactly where Katie Harvell testified that my client was at trial. Sir, it's inconceivable that this would not have made a difference, and that, or to go even further, as the state seems to argue, that somehow it wouldn't even have been introduced at trial, even if it was available.
Am I right that some of the witnesses put your guy on one side of the car, some of them on the other?
That's correct, Your Honor. As to our client, they were not. There were all sorts of inconsistencies. What he wore, which side of the car he was on, his height and
so
build.
So we have shaky eyewitness testimony to begin with, but the jury never knew that it was even shakier than that. That's your case, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. But what's really notable is that when it came to their identification of Harvell, there was no shakiness. Every witness placed him on the driver's side of the vehicle. Every witness said he was a shorter man. Every witness said he was wearing brown, dark brown clothing. So they were incredibly consistent. In fact, as the state pointed out, the two of the eyewitnesses were in the car. One of those two eyewitnesses actually pointed out Harvell on the street and called up the police and informed them that she had seen one of the two gunmen.
So basically, your view is the state had a B-minus eyewitness identification case. At least that's what they told the jury, when in fact they had a D.
Yes, exactly, Your Honor. They had a B-minus identification case, and the jury saw that. What they failed to tell the jury was that they had an A-plus case against their star witness. And the state conveniently failed to hand over all this evidence so that it could rely on Harvell at trial. Now, Harvell's importance at trial is staggering. He was the only one that talked about the planning and the execution of the crime. He was the one that said where the weapons came from. He was the one that provided this incredible motive that they wanted to steal the wheels and tires of the vehicle. Without him, it's hard to imagine how the state could have really made a case against Walter based solely on eyewitness identifications, which could easily be explained away by Thomas's confession. After all, we know that Thomas and Walter look similar. We know that the eyewitnesses were shaky. Certainly, you can't say beyond a reasonable doubt that shaky eyewitnesses could not have mistaken between two look-alike brothers.
And what basically we have to decide here is whether or not this was a verdict worthy of confidence. Right?
Exactly, Your Honor. The standard under either Brady or Strickland, and consequently under both, is whether the evidence that didn't come in is enough to make you lose confidence in the verdict. I'm sorry, I see my time is up. May I finish my thought?
Sure.
So therefore, yes, what this court has to decide was whether the Indiana Court of Appeals was unreasonable in concluding there was no materiality. Given the nature of the evidence, it clearly was unreasonable. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. And you took this case by appointment of the court?
I did, and I thank you for it.
And we thank you for your vigorous representation of your client. Thank you
thank
very
you.
Much. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.